Hey, Brussels. It's side two, May 2nd, 1980, tape number 439. That is just a little bit of a song called Someone Saved My Life Tonight, written by Elton John. It's in the Captain Fantastic album, and I think of the person who possibly tipped off the crisis that was to take place in Tehran and trigger World War III. And maybe we have some loyal Americans who are trying to stop this type of Holocaust before it takes place. I feel that there were some forces helping to stop the situation and put the brakes on it. In that same album, there's a poem by Elton John. The song isn't included in the album, but the poem is in there then. It's appropriate to the news of the day, too. And I just want to share a couple of lines with you. There are many people that don't understand the young people, what they think or how they feel about preserving the earth or recycling or solar energy or anti-war movement. But in their music is a message, and it seems so loud and noisy to many people that they don't like rock music. I've always liked it and studied it and enjoyed it emotionally and intellectually, and throughout the music there is a lot to be said. And in this album, there's a poem called Dogs in the Kitchen. And just the first stanza says, this is by Elton John, all our innocence gave way to lust as the peacock spread its fan. And they taught us how to crack the whip while the businessmen get tanned. In the months that passed by, the agents cried, and the flunkies all got paid, while the fortune seekers' pale limp wrists showered us with bright bouquets. Like soldiers on the road to battle, poor boys fight to stay alive. Take a roller coaster or the Wheel of Fortune. Just be sure you can land it on the other side. The poem goes on. Empty-eyed souls with expense accounts take luncheon eating humble pie, while the vultures belch in their swivel chairs and the vampires all wear ties. From the lips of a sweet young starlet, amber eyes and sex appeal or a swan song sung by some finger-snapping kid in a cummerbund in Cuban heels. Though the team survived, the glass house cracked, and the martyrs all got stoned. But a friend outside slipped a file in while the jailer slept at home. The American corporation and the news media never bothered to understand the thinking of Ayatollah Khomeini or the people over in Iran at all. They understand the jingle of money. And in the book that was reproduced, The Writings of Khomeini in Paris, there were a lot of funny things, such as wiping your behind with one rock, and you don't need three rocks, you can use one stone, and how to treat your donkey if it's been sodomized, take it out to the village and sell it, et cetera, et cetera. And in between all of these things are some various serious things that were passed around on tape cassettes through the mosques. And I think the way Khomeini came to power was by people reading the silly things and thinking he was funny, and the actual people who were oppressed reading the serious information. One of the quotations in his book, just right at the beginning, he said, though you may not have the means to prevent heresy or fight corruption, nevertheless, you must not remain silent. If they hit you in the head, protest. Resigning yourself to oppression is more immoral than oppression itself. Argue, denounce, oppose and shout, and spread the truth. And then he went on to say that Islamic justice isn't what they say it is, and the inference, I'm sure, is that Judeo-Christian justice, if you call it that, in the United States and around the world, or the way Great Britain handled their colonies, isn't much different than what we call Islamic justice. It's a figure of speech, and maybe they do a few public lashings or take hands off. But there are things that go on in our own prison systems that are outrageous. We deny people their genitals, their head, their brains, their heart. We program to become killers. We lock them up. We take the profits, the books, the movies, the police force, the SWAT teams, and continue to do the killings and maim and kill young women, hitchhikers, and all segments of the population in order to promote the profits of not only the pornography people and organized crime, but the heads of state who are involved in these terrible scandals. Justice isn't served by any single country or any group of people. And if we don't understand the people we're supposed to live with, then we better understand our opponents or the people we want to attack. When the first stories came about the Iranian crisis, the first accounts that I have in my newspaper, San Francisco Chronicle, explained that when the situation came, they had to go to a special room, the cabinet room in the White House, because the usual war room, the White House basement, known as the Situation Room, was used to monitor the refugee crisis in Cuba. And being as that Situation Room was occupied, they went to the cabinet room. Well, maybe the White House will be converted to the Haiti room, the Brazil room, the Chilean room, the Argentina room, the United States room, because the Bobocracy will take over. If we try to wage a war in the Middle East and all of our oil is blocked off and we are sent to the position in our cities where we're tied off of all means of food and supplies that we need through trucks or airplanes or whatever supplies these cities with mail and postage and so forth, you'll see Bobocracy on the streets, and diplomacy will not reign there, and there will be their war rooms that they already have built in caverns and caves to sit and decide what to do with the pieces. George McGovern was warning this year in an editorial just this last week, beware of military folly, and he talks about the fall of Saigon and the 5 years since it fell and what it did to the United States, and that it was the greatest single catastrophe of national history. And McGovern said, it almost destroyed this country, and it was for naught. Now, after tragedies come in, all the second guesses and the experts roll along, but I'm not aware that McGovern had any say about Brzezinski's policies until now, or Henry Kissinger's policies. He did oppose them during the Vietnam War, but they allow these people to be media freaks, to be eaten up by the interviewers and the press as if they're the darlings of the world. And I don't know what the vote was on Mr. Colby, the head of the Central Intelligence Agency and the Phoenix Program, and the deadly tortures and murders that went on in his hearings to become director of the CIA. He admitted killing thousands, tens, 20,000 people in Southeast Asia, part of a spy mop-up. And then he came to the United States and became the head of the CIA in the United States. So that Vietnam followed Southeast Asia and came right into the United States. But now people are coming out of the woodwork. Even I.F. Stone, who's been relatively quiet, studying Greek and Latin roots and into his classics, has come out with opinions on the crisis in Iran, and the same anti-war people that fought Vietnam and then sat back and let us create the Middle East right on top of the Vietnam misadventure are now back in the woodwork decrying war and getting their newspaper spot talking about the problems in the Middle East. It's pretty long overdue because we are on almost a suicidal race there, and more people better speak up. There's an article in Los Angeles Times, Japan loses its Iranian oil, calls for restraint by the United States. Another article, Japan is losing billions of dollars by going along with it. None of these countries want the Olympic athletes boycotted for going to the Soviet Union. Carter simply had to say, I'm not going to let the Americans go. He tried to dictate to Japan, Germany, Canada, all over the world. There's another article, on top of everything else, Iran has treasure of secrets. This is from the Washington Post. Even though the helicopters were equipped with special explosives designed to destroy the material, it failed to detonate. They didn't send it off. They thought there'd be too much fire in the area, and then the other planes would burn, and then they'd all be left on the desert 500 miles from Tehran. They had wire and thermite explosives, and they didn't use them. The purpose of them was to destroy sensitive paper and gear, and they didn't do that. They didn't want the large amount of flames, I guess, to call attention to what they were doing. The article talks about what they call bad luck with their sandstorm, about their hydraulic failures, how the gyroscopes didn't work to tell what direction they're going in. There was a breakdown of blowers that cooled the power system that operated the gyros. The intelligence maps were left behind, maps of Khomeini's house, and highly secret code gear was lost to the Iranians, documents of other Iranians that were working with the mission that Americans left the names behind. And in fact, one gentleman left his wallet. They didn't even instruct them not to take wallets with them, and this classified equipment is left behind. Also comes out this last week that the helicopters had trouble and were doused with salt water and fire extinguishing foam. Crewmen accidentally set off a sprinkling system 10 hours before they took off, and they'd all been doubts down. They say, of course, it had nothing to do with the problems, but even when they were on the Nimitz, they had problems, were accidentally sprayed with salt water and fire foam. So everything seemed to go wrong, and the question is how much sabotage, how much was on purpose. And then when you read the balancing article that Carter could have had airstrikes, that he had weapons, that he had six C-130s in use for the mission, he had 20-millimeter cannons and rapid fire, he had multi-barrel machine guns, he was ready for a war, he had all the war equipment, and the planes had been hovering over Iran and training, and that he was ready to throw in the military equipment. And if some people didn't want the ordering of these planes, the A-7, the F-4 fighter bombers, they're near the Persian Gulf, if somebody didn't think that they should go out, then I believe that the operation was stopped and that other operations could be stopped also by the same people. Just the Sunday before this operation was to take place, the New York Times had a large article, April 20th, Boiling Point, Military Risk Divides the Iran Experts in Washington. Well, the risks are great. The question of the Soviet Union entering the war, the whole Gulf being cut off from oil, versus staying alive and trying to find something in common to get the hostages out. Those were the stakes. And the battle is really behind the scenes, and we can't say too much now. It'll take years and years to unravel what is taking place. But there was a conflict of to proceed or stop, and the proceed failed, and it seems that there were just too many failures for it to have failed of its own accord. Thank goodness. Somebody saved my life today, as Elton John says in his record. There was violence at the inauguration of Queen Beatrix in Holland. Her mother stepped down from the throne, the Queen of the Netherlands, Queen Juliana. She's married to Prince Bernhard, an executive in I.G. Farben, a known Nazi agent in the pay of Lockheed and Unis corporations, started the Bilderberger Organization, and put the multinationals together to arm, hopefully someday, for this war against the Soviet Union. And then their darling daughter, Beatrice, took over the post. She married a German who's not popular. There were riots in this tiny country and in Amsterdam the day of the inauguration, and there were fires, and people protested poor housing conditions. There are 10,000 squatters in Amsterdam alone. There's a waiting list of 55,000 people for houses. I say that that's a signal for riots in America. I use it over and over again. There's no provision for low-cost housing or taking care of people in the United States or young people growing up. And if they don't have homes, beware. And so there were tanks on the streets and demonstrations and thousands of people, 2,000 or 3,000, in the main square in Holland fighting. Now, none of this is necessary. The profits from Royal Dutch Shell, which is owned by Queen Juliana and Beatrice alone, would build a very small, modest home, maybe a two-room house, a living room, and maybe bedrooms for these squatters with plumbing, adequate plumbing, and maybe a little area to grow their own food or whatever. All these homes could probably be built for 1 year's profit of Royal Dutch Shell, so that there doesn't have to be a waiting list of 55,000 people, and there doesn't have to be 10,000 squatters on the streets. For everyone who is waiting, they're bunched up with another family sharing housing. So it's obvious that the main countries of Europe, the people who have no intention of providing for the have-nots until the have-nots get that mobocracy. So the coronation began not peacefully, and the troubles will not end. She's not popular. Queen Beatrice isn't popular in the Netherlands, nor is her German husband. Jack Anderson had a column this week about what happened in Pakistan last November when the embassy was taken. There were wives of people living in Pakistan, American wives from the embassy and so forth, that were also, they were spat at and urinated on, and they were punched and roughed up, he said, and threatened and molested at the time that the embassy was taken in Pakistan, that the Muslims were angry that the CIA, they believed, had arranged the terrorist attack on the sacred mosque at Mecca. And the Hodding Carter III and the State Department asked the American people not to release information about General Zia. They wanted to work with him. They wanted to give him money. They wanted to arm him. So they didn't want the people to know about the Americans that were attacked, 8 women, a five-year-old girl and others. They were at a fashion show at the time when the mob broke in and pissed on them and beat them up and tore their clothes off and shouted at them and abused them, and they referred to it as a raging mob at the time, going after the Americans. But the Hodding Carter III, the man who signed a book with the Morris Agency, the media freak of the Iranian crisis, he and Brzezinski and their ilk said, don't tell people how Americans are treated in Pakistan because we want to give money to the Pakistani government. They turned down the $400 million and decided to go along with Mrs. Gandhi in India, not antagonize the Soviet Union at the expense of placating the Americans. And all of that was kept secret. If that was kept secret, there was more. But Jack Anderson just released that this week. Now I want to talk on this tape for a few minutes about something a little closer to home that affected me and people I know directly as a result of the investigation research and the links of the intelligence community to private gatherings, the imposition of themselves upon your personal and private gatherings, and in the interesting world of espionage. Going back to tapes 426 and 425, just the week preceding the Abscam scandal, the leaks of the possible arrests of public officials being in the pay of organized crime, I talked about a book, Forces of Power, by William Taub. Taub was a man who was left for dead at the time of Watergate. He was taken off of a road in Switzerland and thrown out of a car and believed to be dead. He was one of the central power movers behind the links of Randolph Hearst with his Nazi connections, with the murder of Generalissimo Trujillo, President of the Dominican Republic, who was murdered by the CIA, links to the Vatican, as I say, and to the Robert Mayhew organization, the group that removed Howard Hughes to Boston, and then he was never seen again. Taub had a lot of information. He was an important wheeler and dealer at all levels of government, advisors to the three different presidents, close associations with the mob, with the church people, and so forth. And as I say, the book is a fascinating book of the whole era, because of the names that run through it and the links. But I consider myself a pretty good reader. I read the book very carefully and underlined it and outlined parts of it, but I overlooked the acknowledgments in the back of the book. I don't know why. Many times I don't read the acknowledgments. I always will from now on, believe me. And in the back of the book, on page 247, he thanks certain people for helping him. He was active in the theatrical business, too, and worked with various people, such as he puts Miriam Hopkins and Gina Lollobrigida. And then he thanks Sheikh Abdullah al-Khalafi, a member of the Saudi Arabian royal family, and Honorable Judge Thomas Weaver. And he mentions a Percy Sutton he thanks for helping with a book, and Cardinal Ottaviani and Oscar Ornstein of Rio de Janeiro. And he mentioned Catherine Rayland, who assisted me in writing the book. Now, the two names that I want to talk about on this tape are Percy Sutton, who he credits with some help, and Catherine Rayland. I went to New York last summer for just about 10 days. It was not a working trip, a vacation with my two daughters. And I spent one day with some very close friends, some who subscribe to the tape, some I have known for a long time. And we spent one Saturday, we had a potluck lunch and supper, and spent Saturday afternoon, Saturday evening of this entire day together. And one of the people that I told that I would be in town and I called was Bob Fast. Bob was on WBAI, Pacifica-owned radio station in New York City that was active through the whole anti-war period. He was probably the most radical or knowledgeable broadcaster on world events coming down at that time, and was very popular with the anti-war protesters and the rock musicians. I met Bob Fast through my article in The Realist, because Paul Krasner, who published my first article on Watergate, Why Was Martha Mitchell Kidnapped, Paul came from New York City and then was brought to California by Ken Casey, and later was in the hands of Stanford Research and the counterintelligence, the very people that actually silenced him and reduced his ability to be creative, and he was doped out of his head from the time he was in California. I never knew him before, but for all purposes, Krasner just became like a zombie. In fact, the last realist that came out was my article, The SLA is the CIA, and Stuart Brand, who put out the Whole Earth Catalog from Stanford Research and Ken Kesey, had pretty good control. Krasner was taken from Manhattan to a house about 60 miles north of here in Watsonville on the beach. And the saga of Krasner would make a whole tape, what happened to him from the time I knew him, the early Krasner, to up to the time when he was hired by Larry Flint. But Krasner had introduced me through my article, because anything he published was news in New York, and this gang were his gang that he was friendly with. He introduced me to Bob Fast, and when there was a conspiracy conference in Boston in 1975, Bob was up there, and I met him, and then he arranged for me twice to speak at the Elgin Theater in New York, and Bob taped the speeches, videotaped them, and we became friends, and I did many, many hours of radio talk, and they used to play these radio tapes on WBAI, but there were people inside the station that clamped down, that hated May Brussel and hated Bob Fast, and the no-no, the thing that I couldn't talk about on BAI were the Nazi connections. You could talk about Lee Harvey Oswald or Jack Ruby. You couldn't get into the Nazi connections, the crime, organized crime connections. And I sent out letters complaining. Mark Lane was allowed on WBAI with Bob Fast, and he could talk and insult me and put me down, and I was not allowed to confront him or confront his evidence. And, of course, I had letters going out accusing Mark Lane of working with the Nazis and concealing the connections of the overthrow of this government to the Nazis, and getting off Dealey Plaza to the real conspiratorial links which I had uncovered in those years. And then there was a big conflict of station management, and Bob Fast was taken off the air and kicked around, and he, like Krasner, was doped out of his head and walking around incoherent and not able to fight these people on a logical, reasonable basis, because each of them was supplied with their own goodies that reduced everything to silly time. And then WBAI lost its station on 62nd Street, and Bob Fast was fired. He's been trying to get on the air for the last few years, and he was kicked off the air. And the person that has been manipulating the agents that were WBAI, that the radio station person who has been influencing what's going on at WBAI, crossing back and forth with the employees that were part of the conflict to keep me off the air and keep Bob Fast off the air, is this same Percy Sutton who is acknowledged in William Taub's book. And I might say that when we had this party in New York, this where all the friends met for the day, Bob Fast came, and he came with a woman, and the person he brought was Catherine Raylan, the woman who works with this William Taub, of all people, with the highest levels of echelon into government, into crime, Nazis, conspiracies, the youth organization. The woman who, he says, helped him write that book, attended that party. Now, there may not have been more than 20 of us there that day. And Bob and this Catherine, and they took a list of the people at the party of my friends that they didn't know or hadn't met, and took their names home with them. And at the time, everyone was outraged. What are they doing with this list? Why do they want them? And then after that, one subscriber got hassled by the IRS and had to go through their books, and another one was hassled. And then the IRS contacted me. I owed $600 this last year, and it turned out I didn't owe money. And they said, you owe $117.20, and I wrote back how and why. And they never answered, and I just paid it rather than open up all the books for $117, I just wrote the check. So three people afterwards were hassled by the IRS, and at this party was this woman with Bob Fast, who evidently, he says he's going to marry her, but nothing in all the discussion there did she ever open her mouth about, about the Nixon story. I mean, here I had published and broke the story of Nixon and the CIA and Watergate, and this woman was working with William Taub and helped write that book, and never opened her mouth to say who she was or why she was there or what she knew. And she sat silently while we had discussions of world events or what's going on. And getting back to Percy Sutton, one of the subscribers of the tapes, one of my better researchers in New York, sent me an article March 16th, this last March, 1980. Percy Sutton finds his place. It's a black man who ran for mayor, evidently, against Edward Koch in New York. And he directs 23 corporations. He invests in oil and coal. He builds plants in Africa. He's involved with New York politics. He has an office on 801 Second Street. He has activities in Rome, Paris, Korea. And then he says, you know, some of my friends are deposed now and then. So he's telling you which side he's on. The article for the New York Post says Sutton has vast empire. He owns 7 radio stations, including WBLS FM in New York City. And it's WBLS where all those people have gone who put Bob Fass off the air and put me off the air. They're now paid by the multimillionaire Percy Sutton. Steve Post, the station manager from BAI, went to work for WBLS Sutton Station. And Judge Sutton, Oliver Sutton, the brother of Percy Sutton, the one who works with Taub, who wrote the book, was the man who busted WBAI, the FM radio station, the Pacifica in New York, and arrested Bob Fass Friday, the 18th of March, 1977. And then they sent in the Sutton sent in people to manage WBAI. This is supposed to be free speech, radio, anti-war, anti-establishment, exposing conspiracies or organized crime or Nazis or the CIA or the Defense Department. So WBAI was completely taken over, evidently, by Percy Sutton, none other than Percy Sutton, and his brother, the judge, is the one who busted Bob Fass, and he wonders why he can't get back at WBAI. He's with a woman who writes for William Taub. He's put out by the Suttons and the Judge Sutton and the radio station that owns WBLS and WLIB in New York City. This Sutton has 18 stations in Italy and some in Africa, and he sends tape cassettes and music all over the world. He also, his son, owns the Inner City Broadcasting radio station. He's friends with Hal Jackson and a top disc jockey and so forth. So the Suttons, the Black Suttons, are very much part of the media, of the operations, the William Taub operations, and putting down a free speech, listening-sponsored radio station with the interchange of agencies. I'll give you the address of John Stanley in New York City, and you can write to him, send a contribution of $1 or $2 for the printing matter on the Suttons and WBAI on Percy Sutton, and he has some sheets and information about the links of Sutton to the station and Judge Sutton to Bob Fass. So the point is that when you get a station that is listener-sponsored, where you get interest generated and hot dialogue going back and forth, in corporation in the face of a black man, a multimillionaire black man with radio stations over the world who interchanges and pays off your agents to keep Mae Brussel off the air, to keep Bob Fass off the air. And not only do they do that, but they manage to wheedle way into parties and take the names of people at the party when it was a very small group of people. I usually meet one-to-one with friends. I don't like large gatherings. I say the ratio of agents to a gathering is usually one agent for every 6 people. But I didn't have more than 10 days in New York City, so I spent one day with a large group of friends, and it was a small gathering. There were many more people I wanted to include, but maybe they were spared from getting their name on a list or whatever. But the person who helped write the book with Taub, who was in the thick of all major conspiracies of the last 30 years, and one of the people he gives acknowledgement for helping him, is the same person that broke apart or was a major part of paying off the people who broke up BAI and is still part of that scene, along with his brother, the judge, who completely demolished Bob Fass in court. So much for the privacy and the private life of Mae Brussel when she goes to New York to try and see a few friends. Wherever I've been put down or put away strongly by people like Lane and Dick Gregory, you find links then to the Larry Flints and the Ruth Stapleton, the sister of the President of the United States, giving the orders, you know, fire Krasner when he was working for Larry Flint, and stop the realists, and close the L.A. Free Press and the White House through the President's immediate family, controlling Larry Flint and his lackeys and closing up their offices in Century City and not allowing any pieces of the truth, even the half-truth, to get out. Mark Lane doesn't even tell the whole truth, but a quarter of it would be too much for the system. And again, it goes right back to the White House and the major international radio stations and lackeys who are taking this and getting this thing off. That's why it's important for me to put my research on individual cassettes and individual small radio stations around the country and not move big, but permeate as far as I can the general consciousness of as many people as I can reach in my lifetime. And then it's up to you to carry these tapes or messages along with you to whoever you can contact. But you can't do it in meetings or organizations. You have to do it almost on a one-to-one level. Well, our time is out. I have much, much more to cover, but we'll do it next week. Never cover it all, but we'll do the best we can. It's Mae Brussel in Carmel, California. Keep your fingers crossed. No World War III this week, and have a good week.